another panel coming up shortly. We're just going to talk about it at the local level. But guys, please come up. Thank you.
Association of Collegiate Esports. It is a membership organization of varsity esports programs within higher education. At that varsity level, which I do have to say is quite different than the larger space, which is club-level participation, it does represent the largest gathering of administrations across colleges and universities in the U.S. And in Canada right now. When did I get involved? So I got involved, and actually I know Melcher's back here, so he actually is one of the first people that introduced me in my previous role capacity with the NEI. Basically brought, we got a bunch of these NEI institutions running these esports programs. What do you guys know about it? And I was kind of scratching our heads going, what's esports, right? Now, I knew about it, and I think that's how I felt that the role was of the, you know, 20 people or so that got involved in that process. I'm the only one that actually knew what StarCraft was, right? But it's from that, it's been really trying to build up the core foundational blocks of what administrations need to run a successful esports program.
Yeah, great, thank you. I've been in this space just over 5 years now. I was working with a company called Virgin Gaming, which is more of a peer-to-peer wagering platform. And then in 2014, I was tasked to help build out a collegiate ecosystem for gamers to meet and compete and have a social, casual, and competitive experience through our platform. With that, we went out and acquired the Collegiate Star League, which was a one-man operation, primarily around StarCraft, a little bit of League of Legends, and Dota at the time. And my primary role is leading all sales, partnerships, and sponsorships, all revenue-generating activities within the businesses, and yeah, I get to work with these two fine gentlemen.
Awesome. I know Michael. I've been at Riot for just over 5 years. I've been in college esports now for about 8. And I actually, Adam Rosen in the back, we were both in college in Texas, kind of organizing tournaments across the state. And we both ended up kind of in this space. When I joined Riot, there was a big focus on there's a bunch of students kind of self-organizing on campus and how can we better support them. When Kurt Melcher called in 2014 and said that they were launching a varsity esports program, we muted the phone and looked around the room confused, didn't understand what was going on. Years later, we're now looking at more than 100 schools with League of Legends programs, and a lot more of our role has shifted from being direct to students to really kind of recognizing and supporting the layer of administration that are ultimately driving the experience directly for students.
Awesome. All right, we got a great group. This is a, we've talked about this, is a no-fluff type of conversation. So we're going to agree and disagree on some things, probably disagree more than we agree. So first question, hard-hitting. Were you disappointed? Let's start with Neil. Were you disappointed with the NCAA's decision to table esports for the time being? And if so or if not, what type of governance is needed?
Put me in a tough position to...
A yes or no question.
Was I disappointed? An absolutely hard no.
Okay. Care to expand on that?
I think the NCAA would have come in, they would have governed it the same way that they have an overbearing administration of football, baseball, basketball, all of these other sports. I think they don't understand the space. They didn't grow up within it. I don't think they necessarily always have the best interest of their players in mind. And I know that, you know, the gentlemen on both of my sides here, they're authentic to the space. They grew up in it. They're trying to do things for the players first and foremost. And that's why you see them creating really great foundations around governance. Now, what we do at the Collegiate Star League is a little bit different. We don't own any games. We don't own any titles. And we don't necessarily work within the framework of the varsity programs. But what we try and deliver is the best gaming experience for students on campus. So whether that be someone who wants to have a social gaming experience, a casual, semi-competitive, or competitive, We want to be able to take care of those people who are on campus, looking to find their community, engage with other people, just find their best friends, find their community, find these people that they love participating with on a Friday night or a Monday night, going to events, because not everybody wants to go out to the bar drinking. Not everybody wants to play intramural sports, but there's a lot of passionate people out there, and maybe they play Fortnite, maybe they play League of Legends. And that's where we come into play, is we're as much a community conduit as we are a competitive league.
Michael Brooks, you're closest to this. You're disappointed, yes or no?
No. I don't think that's a big surprise. Do you want me to elaborate, or is that the yes or no? Okay. The answer to that is, from the administrative perspective, which I spent a lot of my time focusing on, right, the NCAA does a lot that's really good, but for traditional athletics. When looking at esports, I mean, there's a reason why when the NEI was looking at esports, they decided it doesn't fit under their constitution and bylaws. There's a reason why the NCAA spent so long looking at this, is if you look at the core business model behind it, it's like oil and water, right? When you don't own the assets that you're trying to market and monetize, which for the NCAA is primarily media rights, that makes it very hard to find a financial incentive. And that's kind of going to color all the other really good discussions that are there, but that is one of the biggest weights there. For us, it's a little bit different. We were built with none of that in mind, right? We were built on how do we get more institutions to feel comfortable and secure in the space, and therefore see more student participation. And that was it. Whether we can keep the lights on or not, well, that's a secondary question, right?
A quick follow-up for you then. What type of governance is needed to implement national programs?
So, again, I'm biased here. I think what you need, if you want to see real sustainable growth, it's got to be a membership organization. You've got to make the people who are either influencers and decision-makers on their own campuses, and that's, to be frank, students are an important voice, right? They're absolutely important, but they're transitory. And anyone in a higher education knows that. So the question there is, who's going to sustain the program with the long haul? That's always administrators, right? That's an employee of the institution who's building that framework, who has a long-term 5-10-year plan. So for us is, what can we do every single day to make that administrator's life easier, to give them more assurances, more certainties, more tools than they had yesterday? And that's where we focus on. But that comes from our community of institutions, right? The direction they're giving us in aggregate tells us where to invest our dollars, where to invest our time, where to start reaching out to outside partners to build that security.
Okay. Michael Sherman, you own the game. Your company owns League of Legends. Were you disappointed?
I think this will be a surprising answer, but yes. When we were on this stage last year, I kind of talked about three really important issues that are at the top of the docket for us. Number one is governance, two is communication, and three is diversity and inclusion. Three things of which we put a ton of work into in the last year. But ultimately, when I think through the role that the NCAA plays as a membership organization, they're one of the best existing resources for tackling those three high priority issues. I get that the amateurism model doesn't fit in esports, and I think that that is a sticking point. But will I say that that is the sole reason that the NCAA couldn't play a meaningful role in this space? Absolutely not. We had our second RSAA Board of Advisors meeting just a couple of weeks ago after our summer finals in Detroit, and the most common discussion right now is eligibility. And there is a massive existing infrastructure to support eligibility that exists already in athletics. And this kind of goes back to the conversation of, where does it belong? Does it belong in student life or in athletics? And ultimately, I can't, every school is gonna be different, but there is a ton of infrastructure that already exists for ensuring student wellness and kind of creating the best outcome for students built into athletics. Is the NCAA absolutely perfect and can come in tomorrow and just do everything right? Absolutely not. But are they going to be super? Could they be a very valuable partner in the space? Absolutely.
All right. So just a quick follow-up on eligibility: true or false? Varsity esports players on campus should be required to adhere to the same standards that student athletes in traditional sports are held to. Why don't you start?
I kind of alluded to this, but I don't think we can start from just a blanket yes. Yes, I think a lot of the academic requirements are incredibly important, and that's actually a space that we struggle with, admittedly. Like, it's not something we can just say tomorrow, like, we enforce the exact same standards as traditional athletics. But I do agree with most people when they say that the amateurism model doesn't necessarily fit, and I want to clarify that. It's not that there are a ton of students out there earning thousands of dollars playing their game, streaming, and also being a full-time college student. There's kind of a myth that Flare exists or could exist. I don't know if you've met a college student or a streamer, but I've met both, and they could not both do the same thing. So I think that amateurism is mostly an actual implementation problem. It starts out first as an implementation problem. There's not if I won Riot points playing in a tournament when I was a kid, does that count against amateurism? If I won $30 playing in a tournament at my local LAN center, does that count against my amateurism? And how do you even enforce or keep track of any of that? I'm not saying that these people shouldn't get their money, but to even have a conversation about whether amateurism can work or should or shouldn't apply. We can't even, like, realistically enforce it, whether it should or not.
Michael Brooks, what are you in at NACE? What's your position on eligibility?
Well, I'll tell you our official position. I'll explain to you that we've had some big hurdles, actually, here. So the answer to that, in part, is yes. And when we think of eligibility, we pretty much put it into two different buckets, which then determines your final eligibility status. We look at your academics, and then we look at your competitive experience in traditional athletics. For esports, though, whether you want to or not, the question of how would you enforce any barriers when it comes to competitive experience is very difficult to answer, because you can create a profile anywhere, play anywhere, win something. How does anyone know that profile is you? Right, when you can switch it off like your outfit for the day. That makes looking at traditional athletics and amateurism, just from an implementation perspective, incredibly difficult. So what our association did is we focused on what we think we could wrap our arms around, right? You know, in varsity competition, it is considered a privilege in the United States, right? And that privilege knows certain advantages, usually in scholarship dollars, but there's other benefits too, right? The athlete cafeteria, having extensions for test dates, midterms, all that. That all comes from, because it's a privilege to represent your institution, but it's also, there's responsibilities that come with it. So they're trying to balance that scale a little bit. For us, when looking at the academics, we initially try to match it up to what was the NAIs, because that was easier to implement in terms of your standardized test scores, class ranking, or GPA. And then we tried that and struggled immensely with that because, and actually our last convention in July, what it came down to was a pretty robust discussion amongst our membership looking at those models and saying, look, we get why we're looking at that. That was the best standardized way to set some barriers, right? Say, okay, this is an academically sound student that we think is going to have success in college. This one, it probably not, right? To add more responsibility to them when they're not academically sound, it is setting up that student for failure, right? That's the purpose of that. But we realized most high schools don't issue class ranks anymore. By the way, a lot of schools, both at the, because we have two-year institutions and four-year institutions, they don't look at ACTs or SATs anymore, right? So that's gone. And then your cumulative GPA is really the only thing that we have left to look at. We felt that having just that one barrier alone doesn't get a full academic picture for a student, right? To judge someone next level.
That's not awarded, right? Anyway, right?
No. These are through the institutions. So we actually are verified numbers on all these, right? We have a partnership with the College Board. We can pull right from their standardized test scores. Parchment is another service to do that. We're not relying on self-reported data to do that.
All right, so let's talk about relevance. So how can collegiate esports, is collegiate esports relevant even if the path to pro doesn't run through college like it does in some traditional sports? So Neil, what do you have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we look at the path to pro, model. That's an exciting conduit, and I say that because we've done a lot of great partnerships with, you know, I was just speaking to Brendan from the NBA 2K League, and last year we introduced the first ever collegiate NBA 2K League, which we're really excited about, and we're renewing that for a second year. You know, we've had great conversations where a couple years ago, for example, with Madden, you earned Madden championship points by playing in Collegiate Star League. So you actually get out there and you get to play against the best in your region, in your college, in the country, and then hopefully level up and go and participate on a national stage. So we see that's a great place for us to play for a lot of underserved games. League of Legends, obviously, is the behemoth in the space, and they've created a really great model where being crowned the national collegiate champion is a great honor. But a lot of these other games, Gears 5, Fortnite, PUBG, you know, they don't necessarily have that same path. And the publishers are stretched so thin that they don't have collegiate employees, let alone a collegiate infrastructure, and that's where third parties like us can come in and really make a relevant stance to give the gamers what they want, the opportunity to meet and compete, and then give them the opportunity to actually earn those championships and earn those titles. So, absolutely.
Right. Michael Sherman, some of the best league players are college age. So how do you look at the relevance of collegiate vis-a-vis the path to pro?
Sure. There's actually an interesting trend right now amongst pro players in the LCS where the average age of an LCS player, which is our pro league in North America, is getting older. There are longer and longer careers for top league players in the U.S. And part of that is increased team infrastructure, better focus on mental health, trying to prevent burnout. There's a big question of how long can I extend Doublelift's career, because Doublelift is still the best AD carry in North America. So you have a lot of people investing in that. That also means that the barrier of entry to being a pro player is going up. There's an expectation that you're going to have higher qualifications and more experience, which is where college is starting to come into play. I think people imagine that there's a very like clear path to pro. And that is kind of the result of a bunch of steps, but that's a 15-year process. It's not just that college is a path to pro, it's that you started playing football when you were in middle school. And there's nobody who's just starting to play football in college and it's like, cool, here's this next game. College is really interesting because it's potentially the first time that somebody's ever going to have a coach. That's something Bonnie talked about in the last section. And also just scale. I think a lot of pro development programs are all about scale. We have an academy league in North America that features another 50 players, but we're looking at a pool of millions in North America, and how do you help feed that talent up? You need something that's going to kind of help elevate people to the next level each time. So we think naturally as college continues to grow and as more schools continue to invest in it, that it'll be a natural vehicle. Do we need to implement a draft to formalize something like that? We're probably a while off from that, but it's definitely on our radar.
Michael, how do you look at, from a Nate's perspective, is a path to pro helpful for you, or does it matter one way or the other?
It doesn't really matter from like what we're trying to accomplish, right? It's a nice benefit from a marketing perspective, right, to get the attention focused on the opportunities that exist all across esports, so that's for sure. But the way we look at it, the way I look at it is in view with our member institutions, right? What do they want? They want students to come and then graduate. That is their primary goal, right? They want an established path to graduation, so in between 4 and 5 years, that student walks away with a diploma and is amazing for the rest of their lives. That being said, yeah, if you can have one of your players go pro, that's a big plus for that school. That's a big branding initiative. So it's kind of interesting. A lot of the best players that we saw that actually did go from the collegiate space to professional was earlier on in the space when there were only a handful of schools that had esports programs. And I think that was a type of a bottleneck effect, right? You had so many people who were very high level in terms of skill and ability, very few opportunities to play in the professional space. So what do they do? Well, next opportunity is the collegiate space at these handful of institutions. And that's where we saw those players then go pro, you know, 1-2 years in the college space and move on. But as the number of institutions increase and the goals of those institutions are still very much, We want kids. We want them to stay here and graduate. I don't know how that's going to look so long as the number of opportunities in professional space are still so limited. And that's not the primary goal for a lot of schools. So it's helpful. It broadens the spotlight. It gives more attention to certain schools and certainly to the students. But it's not something we're basing our strategy or long-term vision on.
Kind of want to echo something, though, there is that ultimately, like, Riot owns the LCS and we run our college league, but they're completely separate parts of the company. And ultimately, that's because they're serving different needs. And as you mentioned, the role of any of these programs is to enhance the college experience and help students have a more valuable college experience. That ultimately leads to graduation and a degree. And ultimately, that's something that we don't have any metrics when we think about, like, is Path to Pro happening? It's just a side effect of the growth of the space. It's ultimately, first and foremost, our systems need to help push players towards graduation.
Last question for this group is, in my experience at Arizona State, the number one issue preventing that school from being more engaged in a fully supported esports program is gender equity. They just aren't interested in another program and adding a program that is male dominated. How are you developing opportunities? What are you seeing, and how are you developing opportunities for more women to compete in these national leagues? So Neil, can you start with that?
Sure, and that's a pretty hot button topic, and I don't think there's a great answer out there, unfortunately, yet. It's something we all talk about and strive to get better at year over year. In the Collegiate Star League, we skew very heavily male, to the tune of north of 90%. So what our focus is providing the best experience we can, and with that being inclusive and trying to drive folks, whether it be to our 60-plus on-campus events that we have. And we see a lot of people come out and participate, whether it be in Super Smash Brothers or Street Fighter, which we host in a live atmosphere. But when it comes down to the competitive leagues that we run, and we run Division 1, which is competitive, Division 2, which is semi-competitive, and Division 3, which is more social, there is a barrier to entry a lot of the times based on the toxicity of the industry around that competitive mode. And a lot of girls, unfortunately, get turned away, you know, in their teen years based on that toxicity. And that's an industry-wide problem. And we try to, you know, look at it and try and engage with the clubs on campus. So when we go to events or when we're hosting events or when we're talking to the students, is making sure that it's more than just competitive, 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 because that's not what our company is about. We want to be something that when anybody has an interaction with the Collegiate Star League, is they walk away with some kind of value. So whether that be a great competitive experience on campus, we're really pleased with that. But at the end of the day, our business is built around how do you celebrate gaming on the collegiate, across the collegiate ecosystem, whether that be bringing game demos to campus, whether that be bringing live events that other people may have never had the opportunity to attend, whether that be hosting them across our channels, whether that be promoting their streams, or whether that be, you know, hiring our campus gaming ambassadors, which we do actually see a lot more females participate from that perspective, which is just really our take on brand ambassadors in the space. So they go out and they organize events, or they drive registration, or they help run social, or they create graphics for us. So I think as much as it's a hot topic, there's a long way to go. It is on our radar, and we're trying to do as much as we can. But I can't sit up here today and espouse that I've got an answer of how do we bring, you know, gender parity across collegiate esports.
Mike Sherman, how do Riot's wildly successful on campuses? How does your group think about opportunities for women?
So I think a year ago, I mentioned this was kind of a top priority for us. Really, only starting a year ago, and I feel like we've made. We've done a handful since then. So first of all, we actually ran a diversity and inclusion audit last year on our program, really looking at and hiring an external agency to kind of go through and look at how our systems and how our rules and how we're organizing is systemically maybe keeping it from being an exclusive environment. I can't go into specific demographics, but I can tell you that yes, League of Legends itself skews male heavily, but the competitors in our college season doesn't match our own demographics of our player base. So there's already just an inherent problem in the fact that if X percentage of women play our game over men, like, that's not represented in our competitions. So we've kind of taken a couple of actions since then. First and foremost, like starting with our college championship, there was an effort this year to kind of reevaluate our on-camera talent. There were not any men or women competing in the championship on the 18s, but we could definitely change the representation of our on-camera crew, and I think we didn't do enough. I think like we just kind of scratched the surface, and it was something that we just started getting onto early. The second thing that we're focused really much more on for this upcoming season is a new focus on recognition programs. Right now, the only people that we recognize ultimately in our season are the top eight teams that make it to our championship, and then we especially over-index on one school that wins the entire thing. There's a ton of other people that are competing or playing roles in our ecosystem that we're not recognizing in the process there. So we're going to be looking at new opportunities this year to kind of elevate people that are playing all sorts of roles. Some of them are competitors, and I think we need to especially honor the people that are competing right now in a very exclusive environment. On the other hand, we also have a ton, our club organizer scene, as an example, is way more diverse. How can we continue to elevate that and push that further? There's actually a significantly over-indexing women that are leading on-campus organizations, and I think that we've seen the trend of some of the schools that are most successful are there. So we want to continue to elevate that as we move into next year. But again, I think that this is all, I think about this a lot. I think that ultimately the industry isn't doing enough in this space right now. And I think I'll be the first one to say that we can do a lot more.
All right, we have time for one or two questions. So what questions do we have? Yes, sir.
Isn't it a fair point that players peak at the same age as they would be in college? So like a top pro player would be like 19 or 20, and that's the same age?
It's a bit of a myth, ultimately, that we're seeing in a lot more of the mature esports. We've sent the same, our world championship is coming up in November, or in October, and we just locked the three teams that are headed there. Two of the kind of the star role is the AD carry position. Two of the three AD carries have been in the league for 5 to 7 years, and are still like, they're even more so if they're prime now. I think when you especially look back at, I'll lay out the equation I usually like to think about. Tell me there's a 19-year-old who's never lived outside of his home, has never made a decision for themselves, has never played on a team, has a terrible like sleeping habit, terrible diet. The idea that this person would actually be more mature and have the maturity to actually play at the highest level, I just don't think makes sense. I do think that there's always going to be that like outlier, somebody that is like, I can't believe this 17-year-old is now eligible to play in the LCS in the Pro League. They're going to be picked up, and hopefully systems exist that allow that to happen really smoothly. But I think for the most part, it's just not the case.
Okay. Question.
So, what efforts are you aware of or focused on in terms of converting the experience, the esports experience on campus, into resume experience and on ramp to the industry once they graduate?
Yeah, I think I can add to that. So, we work with a number of our partners and our administrations to develop certificate minors, and now actually we have some of our member schools releasing majors. And it's not, you know, you're not majoring in esports, you're majoring in a component of the industry of esports. So it's streaming, audio engineering, video engineering, esports team management, right? Getting a business minor in esports. That's what I'm talking about in terms of capacities are now coming online. And that's what a lot of our member schools are doing. So we're partnering with a lot of outside companies who are experts in their field, which is a great example of that. Their self-interest is developing the next generation of future employees. Ours is helping to use esports as a vehicle to process all those new academic programs that are launching, right? The administrations also go through their hurdles, making sure it's certified, making sure it's going through the right accreditation processes. But esports, again, it's that powerful vehicle that's enabling all that to happen around it.
Okay. All right, one last question. You have a question back here, sir.
Yeah, it was similar to that. Like, talk to me about some of the, or explain some of the minors and majors. Like, what are the concentrations? Are you reaching out to like communications groups, or you know, production minors, or public relations, or marketing, or branding? What type of minors and majors are?
Maybe you can talk to that. Ohio State program seems to be a model of that.
Well, yeah. It depends per institution, right? I wish we could, I could say for every one of our member schools, we look at their entire academic layout and say, okay, these are the programs you need to pull in, and it's cookie cutter. That'd make my life a lot easier. I'd have a lot less gray hair. I'd probably be a few pounds lighter. That's not the case, right? I wish it was. For us, we always default to what is right for our individual institution, and then we try to look at, well, what helps everyone? That's now collective policy. It's actually flipped around. It's the different departments then on each and every one of our member schools that are coming to us expressing interest. And sometimes that's the School of Engineering, sometimes that's the B School, sometimes that's engineering, or I'm sorry, communications. It's not the same across institution. And for our member institutions, they're okay with that because the idea of specializing is attractive, right? Having something that no one else does. No one wants to be the 30th program to offer business esports minor, right? They want to be the first or the second, right? That's where the spotlight comes from. So I wish it was kind of, I can say, across the board here are the norms, but that's not quite there.
Right. Our second panel on local initiatives is going to get into that a little bit in more detail. I want to let's thank this amazing panel.